Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John-Mark Grodi, here at EWTN. And once again, we have this great privilege of coming together to hear a story of faith and conversion. And we're very honored tonight to be joined by His Excellency, Bishop James Connolly. He was a former Baptist and Presbyterian. He's now the Bishop of the Diocese of Lincoln, Nebraska. Bishop, it's so great to have you here. Thanks so much for coming to share your story with us
tonight. Great to be with you, John-Mark. Privilege.
Yeah, it's a privilege to have you, to hear both the story of your faith and how and why you became Catholic, but then also, of course, your vocation story and your current ministry. It's just a real honor. I know we've been wanting to have you on for a while, so I'm glad it finally worked out. All right. Well, let's go back to the beginning. Where did you grow up, and what was your family's faith background?
Well, I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and kind of a typical kid of those years, in a suburb of Kansas City, Overland Park, Kansas. And my parents, although not great churchgoers, they were believers. You know, they both had Christian values, and my mom was probably more religious than my father was. My father, who was my hero, still is, you know, was one of these from the great generation, came out of World War II, the Great Depression, and he was a gunner on an aircraft carrier, and a great athlete. He signed a contract with the Yankees and played minor league baseball for the Joplin Miners right after the war, and married my mom. And just had that, you know, that great American can-do spirit. And but he was one of 10 kids that grew up during the Depression. So he was raised Baptist. So my grandmother was Baptist, and she was a very religious woman. So even though I didn't have a lot of religious formation or training, we were believers. We didn't always go to church. My mom kind of raised myself and my sister in the Presbyterian church, and we would go to church at a big Presbyterian church there in Prairie Village, Kansas, and mainly not because of any doctrinal reasons or anything theological, but the preacher was a great preacher. And in fact, he had a radio program every Sunday morning. If we didn't make it to church, well, we sat around the breakfast table and listened to the sermon, usually 30, 45-minute sermon. Dr. Robert Manili, who was known in the community as a great preacher. So that was really my religious upbringing. And of course, in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of revolution in the air, and I kind of caught up in all of that. Went to public schools, of course, and that was kind of my you know, high school years.
Yeah.
Played sports, loved baseball. My dad was my coach. Kind of a typical kid, but also long hair, rock and roll, you know, typical of those years.
Did the faith up to that point, had it impacted you? How did you receive it as a young person?
I think back on really what my beliefs were. I suppose I was never an atheist, but I was always sort of an agnostic, kind of a skeptic. If there is a God, great. You know, if there isn't, well, you know, so be it. So I really didn't have any strong convictions one way or the other.
Okay.
I was sort of a tabula rasa. I was just sort of an open slate.
Right, right. All right. What happened next?
Well, then by God's providence, I stumbled really into a program at the University of Kansas my freshman year. I remember there was a career college fair at the high school, and I wanted to go to the University of Kansas because they had a great basketball tradition. I loved watching basketball, and you know, it was kind of one of those universities where there was a lot of kind of revolution going on, and it was sort of exciting time, you know, to go up to university. So I always wanted to go to KU, but I really didn't know what I wanted to study at all. And there was, I remember at this college fair, there was an advertisement for what was called the Pearson Integrated Humanities Program, which was a great books program for freshmen and sophomores. And it was intriguing because on the cover it had a picture of a typical college kid back in those days, long hair, jeans, t-shirt. And it was a knight figure looking up at the sky and at the stars. And the motto of the program on the cover was Nos cantur in admiratione, which is Latin for let them be born in wonder. And so that was intriguing to me, opened up the brochure, and it described a program for freshmen and sophomores, 2-year program, 4 semesters, 24 hours. So it was as the professors would say, it was an experiment in tradition. It was sort of a great books program, but it was sort of putting a new twist onto it, you might say. And it satisfied English and speech and Western Civ. So I have to say that my motives were not altruistic. They were, you know, I said, hey, I can knock out all these kind of boring classes in one integrated program. So, you know, that was really kind of what attracted me to it. And my best friend in high school still is my best friend. We were roommates all 4 years in college, Archbishop Paul Coakley, who's the Archbishop of Oklahoma City. We both were interested in this program, and so we enrolled in that program our freshman year. And it covered 4 semesters and introduced us to the great works of Western literature, which I really hadn't studied. I mean, my public education really wasn't very good. It was all over the place. I don't think I ever read a book all the way through during my high school years. So I wasn't a big reader. You know, you describe this program to people, and it sounds like it was like an advanced placement program, but it wasn't. It was really kind of a remedial program, you know, for students who hadn't really read anything.
Yeah.
And so that program slowly had an impact on me and many, many others. I mean, people have been on this program telling the story of the Integrated Humanities Program. And it was one of those programs, too, that the professors themselves, there were 3 professors, you know, they didn't set out to make converts or anything like that.
Right.
2 of them were Catholic. The other converted along the way. But it had this effect of, by introducing students to truth and goodness and beauty through literature and art, and especially poetry and music and architecture, you know, you were just introduced to these great things and asking these great questions, you know, is there a God? You know, what is truth? What is goodness? What is beauty? Through the first whole year was all pagan literature. So it was Greek and Roman authors. And we really didn't get into Christian writers until the second year.
We're joined tonight by His Excellency Bishop James Conley. Bishop, I was going to ask you about, you know, that program. I mean, certainly many college students in different programs get certainly bits and pieces of that. They read some of those books here and there. But was part of the impact of the program that they were presented perhaps just in a different way, in a more open, I mean, even that motto, this openness to wonder. It seems that even when students nowadays encounter those books, they're presented in a sort of a skeptical view or... So was it partly just how they were presented, maybe in a real openness to what their content was? What made the program so different?
That's a very good question. I think the key word was integrated.
Okay.
That they tried to integrate all of these ideas into a whole to show that, you know, the whole person is formed, not just the intellect, you know, not just the academic, but the imagination. Mm. And what they really appealed to was the imagination of the students. You know, it's interesting, there was always a little kind of friendly debate going on between one of our professors, Dr. Senior, and one of his good friends, Dr. Ronald MacArthur, who was the founding president of Thomas Aquinas College. And they would go back and forth. This was way before Thomas Aquinas College or the Integrated Humanities Program was founded. This was in the 60s, and talking about the crisis of education and what's lacking in education. And of course, Dr. MacArthur would, being a philosopher, would say it's a crisis of reason, you know, that young people just don't think correctly or rationally now. They need St. Thomas, you know, they need to think logically and clearly. And Dr. Senior would say, well, you know, I don't disagree with you. You're absolutely right. He says, but you know, before there's a restoration of reason, there has to be a restoration of the imagination. Mm. So they have no poetry. They have nothing to draw upon because, you know, really the imagination is formed and shaped before the reason. And we need to go back further and restore the imagination. So this, as the professors would often say, the form of pedagogy, you might say, the way they taught was the poetic mode of learning. In other words, appealing to the imagination. Certainly there were, you know, great ideas that we studied in those those wonderful classics. But in addition to reading the books and studying the philosophers and the historians and on an academic level, but we also had a very important part where we would memorize poetry. And we would have sessions where we would just memorize reams and reams of poetry. Oftentimes not even knowing what the heck the poem meant or anything. And I said, don't worry about that. Just memorize it. Just get these poems in your mind and your imagination. And also every lecture was twice a week, would always begin with a song that somebody would come out, and usually an upperclassman, usually a female who was very attractive, so all the boys were just, you know, perking up and listening to her. And she would teach a few verses of a great folk song or an English ballad. I mean, you know, this was in Kansas, so the first song we learned was Home on the Range. And that was an attempt to just lift up the hearts and the imaginations of the students to beautiful music, you know, to get music in our souls. Another thing that was part of the program, which made it different than simply like an academic program, was that we would have each week or every other week, we would go out in the evening and look up at the stars. And just that was really what kind of engendered the wonder. I mean, if there was any iconic image of what the program was on the cover of that brochure of a young college student looking up at the stars and the Big Dipper in the background and learning the constellations, which were, of course, linked to all the mythology of the pagan literature that we were reading. But just to look up at the stars and to wonder about the great ideas. Mm. What is reality? You know, what is the purpose of life? You know, what is happiness? You know, what is love? You know, what is mercy? What is good? What is evil? Those kinds of questions that, you know, you ponder when you're looking up and not looking down, you know, that lifts your heart and your mind. Yeah. So I guess getting back to the question, what made it different was that it appealed to the heart and to the imagination first, and then to the intellect. And that's what I think made it unique.
Yeah. It's a decidedly non-utilitarian approach to those contents and subjects. In other words, not just going to analyze this in order to write a paper, or I'm going to, you know, piece apart this piece of poetry to get at some further end, but just to enjoy and encounter the thing itself. And there's a real connection between that experience and what we would talk about as learning to engage in like contemplative prayer, right? There's a connection there between not just doing something to get something, but to just be with beauty, to just be with truth, and to let it impact you rather than trying to micromanage it and get a particular outcome.
That's absolutely right. It's very well explained. You know, you mentioned utilitarian, pragmatic, because higher education, especially even today, is so career oriented,
right,
and so practical. In fact, it was that way when I was going through, but now it's even more so, where, you know, young kids in, you know, first grade are, you know, already thinking about their careers. What's your career path, you know? And without having gone through sort of the imaginative formation. And that was really one of the things that was unique about the Integrated Humanities Program, that it didn't really, you know, it wasn't so focused on these pragmatic and utilitarian practical things. Although, ironically, you know, in preparing students and giving them this broad whole person education, that's the most practical kind of education you can have, because you can carry on a conversation. Let's say you're interviewing for a job with an employer, and you can talk about things you've read and the breadth of knowledge that you have. So in a certain sense, ironically, that's the most practical kind of education you can have.
Yeah.
You know, I was an English major, and I remember my father, who's very pragmatic, said, well, what are you going to do with that? Open up an English shop? How are you going to make any money? And, but it was because I liked to read, and I really wasn't thinking about becoming a teacher or going to graduate school. It's just that I was drawn to that.
Chesterton has this great essay called Wanted the Unpractical Man. And he talks about, you know, the practical person being the person who stays in the rut and continues things as they're already going, But when there's a problem, as there are many problems in our society, you need the unpractical man, the person who can step back and transcend that and ask those bigger questions and encounter truth and beauty and then return to the problem with that new perspective, with that reanimated heart and mind.
Right. You know, and the whole, another thing I thought of is that, you know, that everything's so specialized. Everybody's in their own lane. Everybody's in their own silo. And so it's really a disintegrated philosophy of education where you just sort of focus on one thing instead of getting this broad connectedness of everything, that the education as a whole and education of the whole person.
Right.
You know, every aspect of it. So that was probably the unique thing about the Integrated Humanities Program.
Yeah. All right. Well, so how did that impact you and what happened next in your journey?
Well, I guess it was in the second year I started to realize that I had to answer questions like, do I believe in God? Is there a God? You know, I think I was convinced there was a God. I don't think I ever, like I said, was an atheist. But I didn't know where God was, and I didn't know where to find him, and I didn't know where to worship and how to worship. And so my second year started thinking more about, I noticed that there were a lot of my classmates who were believers. I didn't realize it at the time, but who also were Catholic. It didn't dawn on me that, hey, there's a lot of Catholics in this program.
And at that time, what did Catholic mean to you? What was your perspective on Catholicism?
Well, I mean, it was interesting because at the university in those years, you had basically two types of people. There were the kind of evangelical Protestants, we call them Jesus freaks, you know, who were always trying to get you to accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior. And I wasn't really attracted to that crowd. And then there were other people who were more quiet about their faith, but they were very serious and convicted. And that was intriguing to me because there was a whole set of people who I knew were very religious, but they didn't wear their religion on their sleeve, and they didn't really talk about it a whole lot. It was kind of like a reverse evangelization. I was intrigued because I knew they went to Mass every Sunday, and I knew that they were very serious about their faith. And whenever I would ask a question about, let's say, the Catholic Church, they would have a ready answer, and they would be very confident in that answer. And that intrigued me because they weren't trying to push the religion on me, which was probably good. I probably would have pushed back. But it was also intriguing because they weren't trying to get me to convert. And it aroused my curiosity, I guess you should say. And more I began to notice this, that, they didn't hide their faith, but it just wasn't that visible until you started to ask and inquire. And that's what started to get me thinking. My first mistake was living with two Catholics. One was a convert, and one was, Archbishop Coakley. He was kind of a revert, I guess. He had kind of not fallen away, but he, had kind of slackened a bit, but then came back strong. So I guess getting back to the program, asking these questions really kind of forced me to think, well, what do I believe? You know, where am I in my faith journey? And once I finished the program after my junior year, and we ended up in the last semester reading Christian authors and, the plays of Shakespeare, we read Dickens, we read Newman, and we had a selection from Cardinal Newman and the idea of university and the uses of knowledge. And Newman just captured my imagination, and I realized that he was a convert to the Catholic faith and that he kind of read his way into the Catholic Church, and it to great sacrifice when he made that decision to convert. And I was intrigued with his life, and so I began reading more and more of Newman. Who is this guy, and what's his story like? And like so many, like St. Paul or St. Augustine, which is another book that was had an impact on me. The third semester was the Confessions of St. Augustine, who was another kind of wild. I kind of likened myself to Augustine a little bit, and then all of a sudden he had this massive conversion. But Newman really drew me, and I began reading more and more about his life and his decision to become a Catholic, and that great line, to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant. And that was happening to me as I as I saw how the Catholic Church had such an impact on literature and art and philosophy and architecture and poetry and music, there was all of these connections that were being made, because the greatest works of the human person, were all influenced by men and women of faith, and the saints, and just great figures in history, and what motivated them, and what inspired them as artists, or as various heroes. It all kind of came back to the Catholic Church, and that the Catholic Church had influenced so much in our culture, law, medicine, everything. And that's really kind of woke me up. So my junior year, I said, I better start checking out this Catholic. I'd done some church hopping, I found a safe place in the Anglican Church, because I read a lot of C.S. Lewis. And I said, if it's good enough for C.S. Lewis, it's good enough for me. And so I began going to the Episcopal Church, which was beautiful. The liturgy was beautiful. The music was beautiful. It had all the smells and bells. And so I was comfortable there. And one of our teachers, who was an Episcopalian, who eventually converted years later, was a member of that church. And so that was kind of a nice, safe place to be for a while. But then as I dug deeper into the origins of the Episcopal Church and the whole Protestant Reformation, then I realized that I've got to go deeper and search more. And then that was my, first semester of my junior year. It was before the OCIA or the RCIA program had ever been established. It was in the 70s, soon after the Second Vatican Council. And so what instruction classes consisted of are just an evening with the parish priest at the local parish. And there wasn't even any a student Catholic center. There is one now. Mm-hmm. The University St. Lawrence Center, a very vibrant student Catholic center, but there wasn't any Newman Center at the time. And so it was a wonderful Irish priest who would just tell stories about the Catholic faith, and as only an Irishman can. Yeah. And he used the Baltimore Catechism, walked us through the Baltimore Catechism, which I needed something very simple. And boy, I guess after 5 or 6 weeks, I was convinced. I mean, all my questions were answered, and I was kind of an easy convert, I guess. I didn't have any problems like most Protestants do with, going to confession to a priest, the place of Mary in our faith, the place of the Pope and the authority of Rome. Those things all sort of just fit in. Mm-hmm. And so I really didn't have any great obstacles when I finally decided that I should come home.
Yeah. Well, let's take a little break there, and we'll come back and hear about coming in and the change that made, and then what happened next. Obviously, everything since then in your vocation and becoming bishop and all that.
So, all right. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll be back in just a few minutes, so stay tuned to hear the rest of Bishop James Conley's story. I want to remind you that if you visit chnetwork.org, you'll find all kinds of resources to help you on your own spiritual journey. And especially if you're a convert to the Catholic faith, we'd love to hear your story. We'd love to have you as part of the network, sharing your story, and helping others to discover the truth and beauty of the Catholic Church and make the journey home. So check that out at chnetwork.org, where you can sign up. But as I said, we'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Bishop James's story. We'll see you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of our hour tonight, speaking with His Excellency Bishop James Conley. He is the Bishop of the Diocese of Lincoln, Nebraska, and he's been sharing his story with us tonight. Bishop, a little bit of background in your parents with your mother was Baptist, and you... your father's side?
My father was Baptist. That's my mother's Presbyterian, right.
As you said, grew up a believer, but really... being impacted by that integrated humanities program, and finally the decision, seeing all these pieces come together, the truth, beauty, and goodness, this decision to become Catholic. And that's where we left off. And so let's pick it up there. You entered there at the university parish?
I did, really, at the end of the first semester of my junior year. And I made the mistake, I don't recommend this to everybody, but I didn't even tell my parents. They kind of knew I was thinking about the Catholic Church, and so I came home at the end of that semester for Christmas break, and announced to the family that I was now Catholic, you know, and of course, that was, you know, it kind of caused a bit of a shock. My mom, she was very happy. She was just happy that I had got my hair cut and I was kind of cleaning up my act, so to speak, and yeah. was going to church. And, you know, she didn't really care what church it was, but that I was, you know, kind of on the track for religion.
Yeah.
My father, it was interesting. He reacted differently. He said, "Well, son, I hope you know what you've done. You've just given up your freedom to think on your own, that the Catholic Church is going to make all your decisions for you now, that the Catholic Church is going to make up your life. Your Pope's going to tell you what to do and what not to do, and you've just given up your freedom to think." And of course, like most converts, I immediately launched into an argument with him, and I said, "No, I can still think on my own. I'm not going to, you know," and all this kind of, and so, you know, that kind of was a tension there, because he, you know, he came out of this sort of, you know, world of this self-sufficiency and, you know, self-initiative, and you're your own man and pull yourself up by the bootstraps and you can do anything you want to do, but this freedom and independence is so important, you know, as an American and as it's true. I mean, a lot of the virtues that I have today are because of his ethic, his work ethic, for example.
Right.
But so anyway, we get in arguments and everything. And so fast forward about 15 years later, and I'm a priest about 5 years. And unbeknownst to me, when I was a priest student in Rome studying for a graduate degree that my bishop sent me to study, my parents kind of quietly started taking classes to come into the church. And I got this letter from my mother that, you know, right before I came back from finishing studies, that your father and I have decided to become Catholic and that we would like for you to receive us into the church. And unbeknownst to me, that they had never been baptized. So I had the great honor and privilege of baptizing my mother and father and confirming them and giving them the first Holy Communion.
Beautiful.
In my first parish. And I always tell a little story, because when we're at the baptismal font, my mom steps up, and, you know, and that's why I baptize her. And then my father steps up next. And right before I baptized him, this was the Holy Spirit. I said, "Now, Dad, you know, if I do this, you're going to have to give up your freedom to think on your own, that the Pope's going to make all your decisions for you. And are you sure you want to do this?" And he said, go ahead. And they both became, you know, very devout Catholics, and both passed away, and, you know, buried them both from their home parish in Overland Park. So next to my ordination day, that was the happiest day of my life.
Beautiful story. Yeah.
So I was received in the Catholic Church, and at the end of that semester, and then by God's providence, and I think this is an important part of my story, which I don't really tell too often, but the older I get, the more I realize how important it was, because, you know, a lot of the stories of converts, and I don't know if the survey is accurate, but some say that those who come into the Catholic Church within 3 to 5 years, almost half discontinue practicing. I don't know if that's true. I don't know, but I read that somewhere. And part of it, they say, is because they don't have a community to come into, you know, that they make this decision and then all of a sudden they're sort of left out there, and then they just sort of drift away. But I had the great gift of being baptized into this, you know, community that was already existing in the university. And right after I became a Catholic in December of 1975, in January of 1976, we had a semester abroad with this program and took about 150 students over to Ireland. And back in the mid-70s, Ireland was thoroughly Catholic. You know, it's come under rough times now, but we were in Galway in the west part of Ireland, and we spent half our time in the city of Galway and half our time on a little island off the coast of Connemara called Inishbofin. And I remember going to daily Mass as a new Catholic. I'd only been a Catholic for a month and a half or so, and going to Mass in Galway, and there'd be like 100 people at daily Mass. I mean, the faith was very vibrant. And that was my introduction to the Catholic faith. So not only was I in a community of young people, who many of whom were converts like myself, and so we had that bond. And you know, when I look back on my conversion, you know, you could say that I read my way into the Catholic Church. But I look back on it now, and it was more the relationships and the friendships that I made. And it was seeing faith lived out, like I talked earlier, in other people. I think Newman says somewhere, the greatest influence on a human soul next to supernatural grace is the example of virtue in another person, goodness in another person. And it was really that goodness in other people living out their faith that had such an impact on me in the end. I mean, it was there was an intellectual thing going on, but at the same time, my heart was being moved because of the example and goodness of my friends. So we're in Ireland, and within 10 days, we're on the little island, half of us are, two of my classmates drowned in, wow, in the ocean. And we are out exploring the island and going out on the outskirts of the island, and there were four of them that were there. And they were exploring, and the tide was coming in, and they got cut off from the mainland. Two got onto the main part of the island, but the two were stuck on what's called the Stags. And the sun was going down, and we don't really know what happened, but we think that they tried to cross, and they were swept away by the tide. And of course, this was a tremendous tragedy to us all. And you know, it was the reality of life and death, you know, and you know, it shook everyone. And of course, we had to decide whether or not the whole trip would be ended and we'd return back to the United States. But the students voted and they wanted to go on. The two young men, Ed and Richard, both of them were Catholic. One was a convert like myself who had just come into the Catholic faith, would have wanted us to stay. And so we stayed the semester, but we had the funerals, and it was a real tragedy. But it bonded, you know, like these kind of things do, it bonded us so tightly together that we clung to one another in that tragedy. And there was a priest who was on the island that was probably in his 20s. He seemed to be, you know, older than that, but I realize now because he's just retired, and I know Father Martin O'Connor is his name. And I guess they had the practice in the Archdiocese of Tuam of sending the young priest out to the islands as their first assignment. So he was our pastor on that island, and he became a father to us, you know, and that's where I really first experienced the fatherhood of the priesthood. And I think there was probably some seeds planted there for my eventual vocation as a priest, because he really fathered us through that tragedy and pastored us through that tragedy. And that was my first really experience of a Catholic priest, was because I'd just become Catholic, and I really didn't have, I had a relationship with the pastor of the parish in Lawrence at the university, but this was really kind of living day in and day out with a priest, a father, a pastor. And so I think that had an influence later on in my discernment to the priesthood. But that was a big impact. That was an important part of my early months as a Catholic, to be welcomed into a community and to have a community surrounded by faith believers. That it's so important for converts to have a community to go into, a parish community. I mean, we just had the rite of election on Sunday, you know, and we had all of these people who are journeying into the Catholic faith. And one of the things we did at the end is we invited them to become involved in their parishes, to become involved in different apostolates, become involved in different activities in the church so that they can be connected once they become Catholic. But that was very important. And the other important thing that happened that first few months is at spring break, we took a trip, about 40 men, because there were a couple of the students heard about this monastery in France called Foncambeau, Our Lady of Foncambeau, which was a Benedictine monastery, flourishing monastery, Gregorian chant, Latin liturgy. It was something that was kind of fit into our academic studies as well. Gothic or Romanesque architecture, beautiful 11th century, 12th century church, which was restored to its splendor of the Middle Ages. And so we took a spring break there, and we of course went to Paris, and everybody enjoyed that. And then we went to this monastery, and we saw sort of this living monastic life, and it had a big impact on a lot of students. In fact, two of the young men that were on the Stags with the two that drowned ended up entering that monastery later on.
Wow.
And a number of students entered that monastery. And that monastic experience had a big impact on everybody's life, especially the 40 that went there for that spring break. And I ended up going back to the monastery after I graduated from college and spent about 9 months there discerning whether or not I should become a monk, a Benedictine monk. And of course, as the story unfolded, many of those students who did enter became the founding monks of Our Lady of Clear Creek in Oklahoma. In 25 years ago, as a matter of fact, they're celebrating their 25th anniversary. A group of those monks came to Oklahoma at the invitation of the Bishop of Tulsa to establish an abbey there in the Diocese of Tulsa. Wow. So that experience of contemplative life, and that's really where I learned how to pray.
Yeah.
It was having that contact with the monks and the whole Benedictine spirituality. Mm-hmm. And eventually I look back, at those experiences in my first 6 months as a Catholic as sort of being seeds that were planted eventually for my vocation.
Yeah, that this notion of learning how to pray, I've come to appreciate over the years the journey of prayer. We go on many different journeys as Christians, coming to know Christ, becoming Catholic, our vocation, the sacraments. But prayer, there's a journey in it, in the sense of certainly you'd prayed in different ways during your life, but all of us, the Catechism, gives us these three key expressions of prayer, right? Vocal prayer, meditative prayer, contemplative prayer. And not all Catholics recognize that there's a journey there, that we begin by memorizing, the great poetry of the Church, the great prayers, doing the liturgy, all that. But then we're to go deeper in those things, to learn to really be with God. There's this deeper contemplative prayer that's not just reserved for the mystics or the great religious, that all Christians are called to that, to seek and to learn to be in that close intimacy with God. But that takes, really, that example of seeing it lived out is so important to learning that kind of prayer.
Yeah. Yeah. And we go through different seasons of prayer,
right,
in our seasons of life. We go through really dry periods of prayer where prayer is really hard.
Mm-hmm.
We've all gone through those times, and then we sort of have to renew our prayer life throughout our lives and renew our commitment to prayer. Retreats are always good for that, and the Church provides us with seasons as well to renew our prayer.
Right. So that trip, a couple really informative experiences. What happened after that?
So I discerned that I didn't have a vocation to monastic life. And so I came back after about a year and a half traveling in Europe. And a friend of mine had inherited his grandmother's farm. And by the way, he just passed away. God rest his soul, Philip Anderson. He invited me to come and live with him and his new wife and help farm, because he knew I was single and needed help on the farm. And so I moved out to north central Kansas, and growing up in the suburbs of Kansas City, I had no contact with rural life. But when we were at the monastery for those 9 months, which was a working farm, I fell in love with the rural life and saw the beauty of living out in the country. And he was farming with horses, which was very unusual, very radical. And it was kind of, he was doing organic farming and living before it became cool, back in the 70s and 80s. And so we lived basically subsistence farming. In fact, we didn't have electricity or running water to begin with.
Wow.
And we raised all of our own food, and we lived just very simple. A couple more couples moved out there in the community, and we would pray together. We would pray morning prayer and evening prayer together, the little office of the Blessed Virgin Mary. And we just kind of formed a little Catholic community there. And it was a beautiful, beautiful way of life, and simple, but back to the earth and very connected with nature, which I think is so important. As Dr. Senior would say, contact with the really real, we're, now, I mean, that was almost, 50 years ago. We've become so disconnected with the real now, with technology and everything. That experience of living connected to the earth and to the stars and to the plants and the animals was really formative. And it was living in that very simple rural life that gave me the opportunity to really discern my vocation. I thought I was called to get married. I had a girlfriend. In fact, we were very serious, pretty serious. I was kind of the fifth wheel. I didn't have a, you know, I was a bachelor. And so I knew I, you know, wanted to have married and have a family. And everything was falling into place and kind of knew what I wanted to do and what I thought God wanted me to be. And then something happened. In 1979, the new Pope, John Paul II, now St. John Paul II, made his first visit to the United States. And one of the stops he made on that first trip in 1979, and he went to, I think, Boston, New York, Washington, Philadelphia, Chicago, and Des Moines, Iowa, which was the closest to us. And so we all kind of piled into vans and drove out to Des Moines and, you know, and stayed out and got there early, and it was a rainy day. It was the Feast of St. Francis of Assisi, 1979, and you know, the first time to meet this new Pope, kind of had, you know, made an impact already in his initial year as Pope. And it was really at that Mass that, at the end of the Mass, as he was wont to do, he made an appeal to the priesthood and to young men especially. And he says, you know, come, follow Jesus, you know, become a priest, follow me. And, you know, that had a huge impact. And I happened to be, there were some people who needed some assistance to get to the front. And so a bunch of us volunteered to take some wheelchairs up the front. So it was sort of a ticket to the front row. And I remember he came by and he blessed this group of people in wheelchairs there who were wheelchair bound. And he would look, I swear he looked right at me when he was saying those words, you know, and that I'll never forget those eyes. And that just really struck a chord in me. And it was in the fall of 1979, and it was during harvest, and we were spending a lot of time out in the fields, and I had a lot of time to think about and contemplate that experience. And then by January, I was in the seminary. And,
wow.
And the process was very quick back then. I'm glad it's not that way anymore. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more discernment that goes on. But I had some friends. The girl I was dating was in Wichita, so I ended up going to the Diocese of Wichita when I went to the bishop there and met with the bishop. And I was off to the seminary in January and wow. Never looked back.
That's incredible. Well, we have just about 10 minutes left, so... what was seminary like and what happened after and how did we end up here?
Well, you know, no one ever knows or realizes, you know, that they're, you know, called to be a bishop, but I've been a bishop 16 years now. And my priesthood is a beautiful, I have nothing but great memories of my early priesthood. I was in a couple of different parishes in my diocese. Spent a couple of years in Rome as a student, and then was called back to Rome and worked in the Vatican for 10 years. So I had a stint there. It was then the Congregation for Bishops, now the Dicastery for Bishops, and had that wonderful experience of living in the shadow of Peter. And most of those years were under St. John Paul II, which I can... I'm a JP2 guy. I'm a guy that kind of traces my vocation back to him, as so many young priests today. And then Benedict, I was there for the death of John Paul II and the election of Benedict, and served under him for about a year. And then came back and was pastor of a wonderful parish in Wichita. And this is really kind of, I thought, parish I was in was Blessed Sacrament, which I kind of say it's like right out of a Norman Rockwell painting. Beautiful church and neighborhood and very Catholic culture. And then in 2008, I got the phone call and that Pope Benedict had named me auxiliary bishop in Denver, Colorado. And I was, you know, I was really taken aback. It's unusual to be an auxiliary bishop in a diocese that's not your own. And but it was God's providence, and Archbishop Chaput was the archbishop who was already a mentor and hero to me, and so I couldn't think of a better archbishop to serve under, and he was and still is a great mentor for me and really kind of shaped me into the bishop I am today. Just his example of a teacher and his dedication to the church, his love for the church, his love for the poor, his pro-life position, everything, you know, about him. So I was 4.5 years in Denver as auxiliary bishop and then served as the apostolic administrator between Archbishop Chaput and Archbishop Aquila. And then once Archbishop Aquila came, a couple months later, I got another phone call. And I was appointed by Pope Benedict again to be the 9th bishop of the Diocese of Lincoln. That was in November of 2008. And so I've been in Lincoln now, just celebrated my 12th anniversary, so my 13th year there as ordinary. So never did I know, ever did realize that I would, you know, this Protestant long-haired kid from, you know, Overland Park, Kansas, Protestant, you know, that would eventually become a Catholic bishop. So God has an infinite imagination and an infinite sense of humor.
Yeah. Well, praise God for your vocation, Bishop, and thank you for your fidelity to it. You know, we all are well aware that there's so many problems, confusions in the world and in the church today, but what are some of the most positive lights that you're seeing in terms of your work as a bishop, you know, in terms of the church and evangelization? Like, what are some of the things that you're most excited about from your perspective there as bishop?
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, I took some time off because I had to deal with my mental health, which is something that is, I think we're becoming more and more aware of now. That and I still struggle, you know, with the stresses of the job. And again, this sort of ungodly self-reliance that I'm the bishop. I'm supposed to fix everything. I'm supposed to make everything right. And that's not the way to look at it. You know, I always think of that great line from St. John the 23rd, during the Second Vatican Council, his prayer was simply, "Lord, it's your church. I'm going to bed." And so sleep is very important.
Yes.
And so after I came back from my leave of absence in 2020, I kind of was, in my prayer was thinking, you know, Jesus was both a teacher and a healer. And that's where he was most known to be, as a teacher. In fact, you know, St. Mary Magdalene, when she finally discovered it was the Lord, she didn't say Lord or Jesus or Master. She said Rabboni, teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized, you know, that the Catholic Church has been involved in education and healthcare from the very beginning, establishing the first hospitals and the first universities in Western civilization. And so I figured, as a bishop, that's where I should focus my energy, in Catholic education and in Catholic healthcare. And I happen to, you know, be in a diocese which is very strong in Catholic education, or Catholic schools. We have 24 elementary schools and 6 high schools, and Catholic identity is very strong there, thanks to some strong bishops and leadership. And so, but the culture is so toxic now, and it's so hard for young people to continue to maintain their faith, that education, I think, is more important now than ever. And I'm seeing a renewal in Catholic education.
Yeah.
And, of course, a renewal in liberal arts, you know. But more than that, you know, it's a renewal in that personal encounter with Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
It happened for me through the liberal arts, and I think that's an important component to strengthen that tradition in Catholic education, but also for all the subjects, to see, like I was talking about before, education of the whole person, the integrated approach.
Yeah.
So even the STEM courses, math, science, biology, are all connected. You know, it's all part of a whole. And so instead of every subject sort of being in its own silo, that everything is connected, so that, you know, what we learn in the science lab and under the microscope is connected to the history of the science, you know, and the discovery. And God's fingerprints are on everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then the area of medicine, I've become very involved in medicine. I'm the National Episcopal Advisor to the Catholic Medical Association, so I work with a lot of Catholic physicians and medical students and residents. And there's a renewal going on in Catholic healthcare too, putting Christ back at the center, because healthcare, like everything else, has also become very specialized.
Yeah.
And very kind of automated and technologized, so that, you know, you don't see the whole person.
Yeah.
We are body, mind, and soul. And so those are two areas I'm very excited about. I'm seeing a great renewal in Catholic education across the country, as well as in Catholic healthcare, and putting Christ back at the center as the healer.
Yeah. You know, that, yeah, that word integration really strikes me as an important one there, right? That as Catholics, we have a sacramental worldview. We recognize right. that God comes to meet us through things, through stuff, through people. And so our approach to education and even sharing the faith, you know, forming people, it's an integrated whole, right? It doesn't leave out the body. It doesn't leave out the mind. It's the whole person that God comes to meet that person through, yeah, through the truth and goodness and beauty and through their body and through their, you know. So, yeah, that integrated, that's part of our heritage as Catholics.
Yeah, you know, the sacramental imagination. I think the more and more I meditate on that word, that everything is a sacrament in a certain sense.
Yeah.
I mean, you've got the capital sacrament,
right.
an outward sign instituted by Christ to give grace. That's right out of the Catechism.
Right.
But then you offer a sacrament with a small s, that mm-hmm. if God created everything, and he did, and if he sustains everything, then his fingerprint is everywhere, in that God can be discovered in everything. And the key of that is to be in contact with things, you know, to be grounded in the reality of things, like I said, with the really real.
Yeah.
Getting back to real things, real relationships, real friendships, talking eye to eye, face to face, not just friending people. And getting back to, and I think this is, again, mental health. I know that the more we spend time in our heads and only in our heads, we get into trouble. As one of my friends used to say, Chris Stefanik, great evangelist, he says, the mind is like a deep, dark forest. Never go in there alone, you know. And it's true. You know, we need to be with people. But just in contact with real things. And that was the beauty of the Integrated Humanities Program, that we would go out into the country, that we would look up at the stars, that we'd be in contact with real things. And that, to me, is so important for the whole person, and the development and the flourishing of the whole person. And the sacramental imagination is at the very heart of it.
Yeah. Wow, that's beautiful. Well, with just a couple minutes left here, Bishop, a couple things. If there are people in the audience who are perhaps coming from a non-Catholic Christian tradition, or maybe even from no faith, but are sort of intrigued, maybe at that program you described, or the sacramental imagination, with that group in mind, but also with young people who may be discerning a vocation in mind, a couple words of encouragement we could leave them with for their continuing journey.
Well, I think just continue to follow the truth. You know, that was one thing that Newman always never turned away from the light and wherever it took him. You know, that the light will continue to reveal itself to you as you pursue it, and as you continue to pray and to seek God's will, that the light will shine, and that light will shine on beauty and goodness as well. And that, you know, beauty can lead us to many places. And I think that's one of the three transcendentals that maybe today, truth has sort of been compromised because of relativism, as Benedict calls the dictatorship of relativism. Goodness is compromised as well because, you know, if you're saying somebody's good, then you may be being judgmental on someone else. And that's, you know, that's the worst thing you can do, is to be judgmental. And so, but beauty still has an attractive force. Mm-hmm. And I think just following the beauty of relationships, friendships, the beauty of what you read, what you listen to, your music, what you see in the world, will lead you to truth and goodness.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, before we close, could I ask for your blessing?
Happy to.
Thank you.
Through the intercession of the Blessed Virgin Mary and all the angels and saints, especially everybody's guardian angel and patron saint, may Almighty God bless you and your families, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Amen.
Amen. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, John Mark.
Not only for sharing your story and for sharing your vocation story, but also for your fidelity to your vocation and your continued journey. Thank you so much for sharing it with us.
Thank you very much. Privilege.
Thank you. And thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Bishop Conley's story is an inspiration to you. Again, as we always remind each other here, we remain people on a journey wherever you are, whether you're thinking about becoming Catholic or coming to faith for the first time, or whether you've been Catholic all your life. This day, Christ is calling you into deep prayer. He's calling you to discern and to boldly take the next step in your journey of faith. So let's do that together. And as Bishop reminded us, Community is so important for that. You know, for a new convert or for wherever you are in your journey, you need to find people that can encourage you and inspire you and hold you accountable for continuing that journey of faith. And so let's stay connected. Let's continue the journey. We'll be back again next week with another story. In the meantime, God bless.